Workplaces are focusing on sexual harassment training now more than ever, but how effective are those methods?
Changing the culture around sexual misconduct is not something that has a finite end goal, so we're going to continue our efforts sort of no matter what, because we believe it's the right thing to do.
That's Bree Van Dam, who helps manage sexual harassment training at her workplace. We talked to her and others about how they're hoping to affect change. Also, the only physicist in Congress and suburban Chicago Representative Bill Foster explains why he thinks it's important to continue to fund our national laboratories' scientific research.
The payoff is often not immediate. The payoff may happen decades in the future. And that's too long a time scale to get investors to put money in, but it's a perfectly appropriate use of taxpayer money.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Whether on the news or in casual conversation, we're all talking about sexual misconduct and harassment in a variety of settings. Whether that's in politics, at bars, in the entertainment industry, in journalism, but of course, one of the original settings for people to experience sexual harassment has always been the workplace. While the EEOC reports a fourfold increase in visits to their site since the Harvey Weinstein story broke, another study done by the EEOC, that's Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, in 2016 found most trainings fail because they're focused too much on preventing employer liability rather than actually making any kind of changes to workplace culture. That's according to a recent report by PBS's NewsHour's Rana Natour. We're going to be talking about this issue today, later checking in with people who are trying to change the culture in their workplaces, see how organizations in Illinois are handling this. But first, let's start with Rana. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
So that study from the EEOC I mentioned was back in 2016, that report I mentioned about workplace trainings fail. Rana, what else did that report say?
Well, it was part of a task force that brought together academics with attorneys and just a diverse group of people. And it also found that like you had said in your introduction, that a lot of these trainings are focused on liability, but that they recommended going broader than that. We need to focus on prevention and making sure that people understand what sexual harassment is and a genuine effort on behalf of the employers to prevent that behavior and not just protect themselves.
Now, one of the lawyers that you talked to for your story says he's seeing about a 50% increase in demand. Did you get a sense from your reporting that there's a growing demand for changing how training is done, or just that people are asking for training? And again, when you're talking about the legal standpoint, is it for companies just trying to protect their liability?
I think companies are increasing their investment in training, and a lot of them are moving from online training to in-person training. And the reason that it wasn't as common before is in-person training is more expensive and it's more time-consuming for your employee and it's more time-consuming for you as a company to set this all up. But a lot of them are realizing that the stakes are getting higher. Just because they might win a lawsuit, an employee might go to social media and they might have a PR problems on their hands too. So it's not just about liability now. It's also about the kind of public narrative that can happen about a company. So the trainers expressed to me that, yes, there is an increase in demand, most certainly. But a lot of them are concerned that that we're not delivering the right message in this training, that we need to be sure that people understand that sexual harassment is illegal because it does not give women and men access to equal opportunity. And that's what that is about. And some of them expressed concern that men would avoid women or colleagues, subordinates, informal interaction, or mentoring because of their concern about sexual harassment in this heightened environment. And so I think it's important within the context of these in-person trainings to emphasize and to remind people of why this is a problem in the first place, because it freezes women out of opportunities that men might have. So that was one thing that I heard from trainers time and time again.
I'm speaking with Rana Natour. She's a reporter for PBS NewsHour. We'll tweet out a link to her story. You can follow 21ST Show to see that. Your story, Rana, included a sexual harassment video from the 80s, a training video that yes. sent our producers down a YouTube rabbit hole looking at all of these videos. We actually, to your point about these trainings and how they are, we put together some snippets of training we found online.
Today's topic is a serious one. We're going to talk about sexual harassment in the workplace. The goal is a zero-tolerance, harassment-free workplace.
At the close of this session, you will be able to explain what defines sexual harassment, why it is important to prevent sexual harassment in our workplace, and understand your responsibilities under our policy and procedures.
Sexual harassment isn't funny. It can be devastating. Personally and professionally, and it's against the law.
Say, man, you still dating that girl upstairs on the fourth floor?
No, she broke it off. Oh, but hey, check it out. She's not gonna be so high and mighty once this gets out.
Whoa.
Nice angle, right?
Ah. Woo, bad move. Bad move, dude.
Most employers strictly enforce prohibitions against this kind of activity.
I gotta delete this.
Good luck with that.
Whether it occurs on employer systems or happens off the job, but ends up affecting the workplace.
It's a little compilation of training videos that we found online. I want to thank producer Alan Montecelio for putting that together. Rana, I think when people are listening to that, they kind of roll their eyes. They're kind of groaning. I think all of us who have sat through these, particularly online trainings, there's a little, I have to say, let's be honest, some of the times they're a little ridiculous because they seem right. like they present these kind of extreme examples or they're very clearly just trying to protect an employer for liability and they're really not about affecting change. How are you seeing training change? What are you hearing about effective ways to create workplace cultures where this is where we're removing this as a problem?
Well, I think a training session can be incredibly effective technically, but if after that training the employees are seeing incidents of rampant sexual harassment go unpunished, then it almost becomes a completely fruitless exercise. So training is part and parcel of a bigger change that needs to happen in the workforce. But I think interactive training and in-person training can be really effective because then you can talk about real-life situations that are relevant to the people that are listening to it. If we're talking about a factory, well, that in-person trainer can use an example that might really happen in these people's lives. And it allows people to talk to each other in these groups about things like there's usually a question and answer session at the end, and it can form an important dialogue and temporary of what's really happening in that particular workforce. So that's where I think some improvement can be had. And a larger improvement is just in the cultural conversation that we're having now. It's happening outside of the walls of the company that's holding these sessions. And I think it's been so powerful to see people actually getting punishment for really bad transgressions that have been going on for years. That's a powerful indicator, too.
As you're listening to this conversation, we'd love to hear from you how you'd like to see sexual harassment training change at your workplace. You can tweet us your thoughts. Our handle is 21STShow. You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Rana, can I just ask you one last question about how you've seen training change over the years and if you think training is changing to affect the kind of change you're talking about?
This was actually a fascinating find for me that I wasn't aware of. There has been an evolution of these trainings. At the beginning, in the 1980s, when the federal government first said that sexual harassment was an illegal form of discrimination, the beginnings of these trainings were really kind of activist bent. It would feature real-life testimonies from victims, even from harassers. It would include legal advice for that victim, write down harassment incidents, document it, tell friends, and it would be really an empowering training for some people. And as it became more professionalized, it changed into kind of a rote announcement of what what to do, what this is, and it didn't really have that soul, that compelling narrative that it had before. And so I think including and infusing some of that old aspect of it, just compelling narratives, compelling testimony, something that feels real to people and emotional, is a powerful thing.
That's Rana Natour. She's one of our public media colleagues. You can see her reporting with PBS NewsHour. Rana, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
I want to introduce Sharmalee Majmudar. She's the Director of Strategic Partnerships at Women Employed. That's a Chicago-based organization that advocates for gender equity in the workplace. Sharmalee, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
As you were listening to that conversation with Rana, I wonder if what she said matches up with how you're understanding sexual harassment training in the workplace.
Definitely. I think that training always needs to be placed in context with the holistic approach to preventing and responding to sexual harassment in the workplace. And so if we ever expect that training in and of itself is going to be the solution, we're going to be disappointed.
Can you explain a little bit more about the work you all do with Women Employed? I'm curious, as you explain that, if you've also seen more people reaching out to you in the past couple of months.
Sure. Women Employed is an advocacy organization. We work on advancing gender equity in the workplace through creating fair workplaces and increasing access to education for adult women. Our goal is always to make it as possible for women to succeed in the workplace and to ensure that they have equal opportunity to do so. What we've been experiencing is just more conversation, I think, a desire for people to understand, okay, this is an issue, this is what it looks like, but how do we address sexual harassment? And particularly given that there is every day a new narrative that we see in the media about an experience of sexual harassment in the workplace, many of them often devastating and ongoing. I think we're helping to do what Rana spoke about, which is really to make it real, to make sure that people truly understand what sexual harassment is and what the impact is that it makes, and ultimately that it is discriminatory. It fundamentally affects women's ability, and not just women, LGBTQ folks as well, experience sexual harassment at a high rate. It affects ability to succeed and to truly be part of the overall experience of an organization or a business.
I'm speaking with Sharmalee Majmudar. She's with Women Employed, a Chicago-based organization. She's explaining the advocacy work that they do. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. You can tweet to 21STShow is our handle, or give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. Sharmalee, before we get to what the actual law in Illinois is, I think that what this sort of national conversation, the Me Too movement, the Harvey Weinstein story, all of these stories of different men who are now losing their positions and women sharing their stories of what they went through has kind of, I think, established for a lot of people kind of a scale of, for lack of a better term, of a range of how harassment can occur. I wonder if you can give us a sense of what your definition of sexual harassment is, because I think for some people there are egregious things that seem very obvious, but then I think people worry about what they think might be gray areas. And I think that's got a lot of people concerned or confused and also not wanting to do or say the wrong thing.
Sure. So ultimately, harassment is unwelcome or offensive conduct in the workplace that is based on sex, which includes sexual orientation, pregnancy, gender identity, and it's detrimental to an employee's work performance, their ability to advance professionally, and or kind of their health and well-being. A sexual harassment can be pervasive. It can be a result of a hostile work environment, and it is always unwelcome. And that's as defined by a reasonable adult.
Okay. So that, I think that makes sense. Something that's unwelcome that any reasonable adult would not welcome. What does the law in Illinois say about sexual harassment, about sexual harassment training? Do we have any individual protections here in Illinois apart from federal law?
So this is interesting. As far as training specifically goes, training is not required by law. Sexual harassment training is a best practice. The EEOC, as well as other agencies, would certainly recommend strongly to employers that they provide training. And it's part of what an employer can say in response to a report of sexual harassment, that, you know, we did provide training, this is what that training looked like. But it is not required by law. California does require training for employers of 50 or more, specifically towards supervisors. But training is not a required element of any business here in Illinois or at the federal level.
And then the legal protection would be obviously that just sexual harassment is against the law. So that would kind of be, well, training isn't required. Obviously, sexual harassment is illegal.
Sexual harassment is illegal, and very importantly, retaliation is also illegal. So being retaliated against because you've made a complaint, regardless of what the outcome of that complaint is also illegal.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Sharmilee Majmudar. She's with Chicago-based Women Employed. They're an organization that advocates for gender equity in the workplace. We're going to be joined after the break by someone who's working on this in her workplace, which happens to be at a field station in Alaska. As always, we welcome your questions or comments. You can tweet to 21STShow. You can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. Again, our handle is 21STShow. Stay tuned to the 21st. I'm Nyla Budu. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. Welcome back. I'm Nyla Budu. We've been talking about sexual harassment training, what works, what doesn't. For months now, we've read and heard stories of sexual harassment. We've been talking about this with Sharmilee Majmudar. She's Director of Strategic Partnerships with Women Employed. That's a Chicago-based organization, an advocacy group, as she's been explaining to us. They advocate for gender equity in the workplace. I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation. Bree Van Dam is the Environmental Data Center Manager at the Tuluk Field Station at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where she also helps develop sexual harassment policies and procedures for the field station. Hi, Bree. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
So, Bree, we actually had you on the program last year, and it was specifically to talk about this issue of sexual harassment in field sciences. And before we get to your sort of reaction to recent events, I wonder if you can explain to us about the Tuluk Field Station in Alaska. It's kind of a unique workplace and living situation that has definitely affected how you all develop training and policies. Can you explain a little bit what it's like, your job?
Yeah, definitely. So the Tuluk Field Station, like you said, we're located about over 100 miles north of the Arctic Circle in Alaska. So we're on the north side in the northern foothills of the Brooks Range. And we're a scientific research station, so our mission, we support research and education to help researchers who visit understand the Arctic and its relationship to the global environment. So we're unique because we're located, an eight-hour drive north of the nearest city, which is Fairbanks, Alaska. So we're pretty remote and isolated community of scientists and staff and contractors, construction workers. It's a diverse group of people.
And about how many of you all are there at the field station, Bree?
That varies a lot seasonally. So in the wintertime, there can be as few as 3 or 4 people who work to run the station and maintain autonomous instrumentation throughout the winter. And in the summer, our peak population can be around 150 people. So it varies a lot throughout the season.
Yeah, it definitely does. I wonder, and especially as you have people coming in and out, I think that also makes for a unique workplace environment because you have new people who are coming in who may not understand your workplace culture. I wonder how that affects the way you approach policies and training specifically related to sexual harassment and assault.
Yeah, that's an excellent point and something that we think about frequently because we have people who stay at the station, staff and researchers who are there for months at a time without ever leaving. And then we also have people who come and visit for only a couple of days in some classes who rotate through, who, visit the station for maybe 1 or 2 nights. And that creates a big impact on the community. And so we try and make sure that we reach every single person who comes to the field station. And that's one specific goal of the training that actually is mandatory for people to take when they arrive at the field station or before they arrive. The main goal is to reach people, and it hopefully lets them know that this is something that we take seriously. It also provides an opportunity for people to access our code of conduct so that they know clearly what our priorities as a community are and that we prioritize respect, especially. And so that's one way that we can reach people, no matter how long their stay at the field station is. We let them know that that's a really important value for us.
And how do you do that? I mean, you say that it's an important value, but what specifically do you do when it comes to training?
So we have a mandatory training, which every single person, it's an online training. It's a simple PowerPoint slide. And we understand, we completely understand that trainings are not the best solution. So we consider it one piece of our entire toolkit. And we also think it's really important to point out that there's no one thing that can address changing the culture or changing the workplace climate. And so our training is just one way in which we can reach people. So that basically is just a simple PowerPoint presentation that, talks about our code of conduct, why we care, the type of community that we want to create at the field station, what we expect from people, the type of behavior that we expect, which is respectful of everybody, and emphasize that everyone who visits the field station has the right to do their work in a safe environment. And then there's a short quiz. And again, this is just one piece of all of our efforts. And most of our efforts, we try and focus on prevention, which includes things like bystander intervention training, making sure that this is always a topic of discussion at our weekly staff meetings and at our annual meetings with our advisory committees and our steering committee at the field station. So making sure that this is a continuous conversation, and that's one thing that the training can do is create and start an important conversation among our community.
Right, Bree. So it sounds like the PowerPoint is one tiny piece of this. When you
exactly.
say that it's right, it's something that's sort of, it sounds like it's something that's been kind of infused throughout the culture of your field station. Can I ask how many people kind of take this on? Is this something that you do? Or is this, in some cases you said there's only, sometimes there's a few people there, sometimes there's 100 people there. I guess I'm wondering at what levels do you feel like people are raising this accountability and awareness?
I have been extremely fortunate to partner with some really wonderful people, and I think it's important that that a team of people address these issues within any community or workplace, because if it's just coming from one person, it's easy to ignore. But I have received incredible support from the management team at the field station and several partners in particular, and also luckily, through the Organization of Biological Field Stations, I've received support from friends at other field stations as well to work on these issues together.
I'm speaking.
But I think that's
yeah.
important. Yeah, it's important to address that this should come from all levels within an organization. So, for example, at the field station, we are considered sort of a satellite campus of the university. So we also partner with a lot of people at the university, and gaining support from administration there is also critical.
That's Bree Van Diem. She's on the line with us from Alaska, where she is at the Tulik Field Station, where she's an environmental data center manager. Bree, obviously lots changed since we last spoke. I think at least among the broader culture and conversations around this, as we were just having this conversation at the beginning of the hour with the PBS NewsHour reporter, Rana Natur, about just sort of the whole culture around now that since the Harvey Weinstein story broke and that kind of has released this whole cultural conversation, lots of women sharing stories, lots of people sharing stories of sexual harassment, not just women. And I wonder what you guys, what your reaction has been for all of you. This is something that's been a really important conversation that you've been having for years, but I wonder what your reaction is to sort of seeing this unfold in the lower 48 here.
I think it's been great in some ways to see this conversation happening in sort of such a large transparent scale, right? You know, it's all over the news all the time. And so I think that's wonderful, and it brings a lot of awareness to something that is so important. I think it's also hard often to hear those stories when you have been thinking about this topic or, you know, talking about it for a long time, to continue hearing people's stories of pain and how things have impacted them at work or at their home or in life generally. So that's difficult, but I think the national conversation has really created a lot of interesting conversations with colleagues at work and, you know, talking about like, oh, wow, this is how this played out in this year. Like, what would we do in this situation? So it creates a lot of interesting and very, very important conversations, or it has here at least, among colleagues and coworkers and friends about the topic. So I think that's really wonderful.
Yeah, Sharmilee, I wanted to bring you back into this conversation. When we're thinking bringing this back to Illinois and to Chicago and the work that you all do with women employed, as you're listening to Bree kind of lay out the culture that has been created within her workplace and how much it's sort of infused across different levels of people, does that give you a sense, I think, of, I wonder if that, I'm sure it gives our audience a sense of how necessary it is to have lots of people involved with this. How do you all do that? What kind of advice do you all offer for people, particularly managers, when they're trying to deal with this issue of sexual harassment and training and changing cultures in workplace as opposed to just, hey, let's watch this video for half an hour?
I think what you just said was really key, which is that it really is about changing and sustaining culture. So I think Bree gave some great examples of what it takes to truly institutionalize this culture of respect, right? That the attitude about sexual harassment or the response to sexual harassment can't just be driven by a sense of we have to comply with the law or we'll be liable. Those are real. But beyond that, there needs to be a leadership level and down commitment to creating this culture of respect, which honestly is going to be better for the business overall, right? Because if everyone is firing on all cylinders and able to be productive and be bringing their best selves to work, then the business is just going to do better than it would if you have people who are worried about avoiding a harasser or concerned about retaliation or any of those kinds of things. So I think we need to think about how the issue isn't just, okay, and we've seen this a lot with the Me Too movement and the reports of sexual harassment. A lot of the focus becomes about whether or not the harasser was a high performer or someone that really contributed to the success of the business. We need to also think about what's the opportunity cost? What has that person's behavior done to the workplace and to others there where they were not able to achieve and succeed at the level that they had the potential to do? And so when you have it, this attitude of respect infused throughout the organization, then you really set the organization as well as the individuals who are part of it up for success. And I think in Chicago and Illinois, as well as beyond, thinking holistically about sexual harassment is really going to continue to be key as we continue to hear stories of people coming forward. And I think it's crucial that we make connections to the larger culture. What can we learn on workplace sexual harassment from all of the work that's been done in the last 10 years around campus sexual assault, for example? How can we make the connections there and understand that the same people who are committing sexual violence in campuses are likely to be the same people who are committing it in the workplace? So we really need to confront the issue in all of those spaces of our society that sexual violence is allowed to continue.
We've been asking you, those of you who are listening, what you'd like to see, what advice you have. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455 as we have a couple minutes left in this conversation. Let's go to Matt from Normal. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the 21st. What's your suggestion?
My suggestion is we're approaching this sexual harassment thing, and you can talk to guys all day long about it, but they're not getting where you're coming from exactly. Like, you're asking straight men that were raised in a pretty much misogynist society, even if they're really good people, they're not getting it, to treat women with the respect, you know, and the appropriate behavior. And what you need to tell them is what would be appropriate if a much larger homosexual man was making advances toward you. Because the way men have treated women for so long, there's things that even good guys don't get. But if they thought about it from the other direction, and not just women coming at them, because women are generally much smaller and weaker physically, you know, so they don't feel the threat that they need to feel when they're thinking about what they're doing and saying, you know, in a workplace.
Yeah, Matt, thanks for that comment. Charmelee, I wonder if you can respond to Matt in terms of, I do think this gets to the point of men trying to figure out what's okay, men trying to put themselves in the position of women, trying to understand this. What's your advice to how you think men in the, not just in the workplace, but how men should be responding to this issue?
Well, I think Matt's observation of how men are socialized is really an important one. I also think, though, that particularly in the workplace, we need to understand that there is actually illegal behavior, and that we can work on developing empathy and understanding. We also have to have clarity, and businesses should take very seriously about making it very clear what they will and will not tolerate, what the policies and procedures are, what options exist for someone who wants to report that they've been harassed. So we can have this larger conversation, right, about how men are socialized and what their role is overall when it comes to issues of sexual violence. But the issue isn't just one of size, for example, that Matt referenced. It's also about power and about being prevented from being able to advance or succeed in the workplace. This is discriminatory behavior, ultimately. So I think that men can and have and hopefully will continue to really listen to what women and others are sharing about their experience. I think that there are many, many men that totally get it, that understand and do not behave in ways that are harassment, either in the workplace or in any other space. So I call on those men to continue to speak to and be leaders with their colleagues, and to set an example and to ensure that they are not tolerating this type of discriminatory and harassing behavior when they see it and when they witness it themselves.
I want to thank Sharmalee Majmudar. She's the Director of Strategic Partnerships at Chicago-based Women Employed. I want to thank Bree Van Dam for being with us as well from the University of Alaska Fairbanks at the Tulik Field Station. Ladies, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Members of Congress are trying to hash out a budget for the federal government by Friday. If not, a potential government shutdown could be in the works. Departments will request funding for their own programs. At issue for many of the Illinois delegation in Washington is funding for our national labs. Illinois is home to the Midwest's largest federally funded research lab and center. That's Argonne National Laboratory. It adds up to 5,000 jobs and $600 million in federal research funding to Illinois. Fermilab in Batavia employs almost 2,000 people. Both of them also have operating budgets of several hundred million dollars. Congressman Bill Foster is especially interested in this. He's a Democrat. His 11th congressional district includes part of Argonne National Labs in Lamont. He's also a PhD scientist who spent more than two decades as a physicist at Fermi National Accelerator Lab in Batavia. We caught up with him yesterday afternoon. Congressman, welcome back to the 21st.
Well, happy to be back here.
I wanted to start by asking you about scientific research funding. Last week's Energy Secretary Rick Perry visited Argonne National Labs and the Fermi National Accelerator Lab. Senator Tammy Duckworth actually requested that visit, but you were also there. What were you hoping he would get out of that visit?
Well, this was the second time I had met Secretary Perry since he's taken office. And so I, you know, shadowed him the whole day during the visit. And I was really impressed at his honest enthusiasm for the science that's done at the laboratories. You know, he made no pretensions about being a technical person. And, you know, frankly, the job of Secretary of Energy has been successfully executed by people without technical backgrounds in the past. And so he saw himself very clearly as an advocate for the science done by the labs under his purview. And so I was really impressed at his curiosity and enthusiasm.
Well, and you had a whole day with him, so I imagine that was a great opportunity for you to spend a little bit of time getting to know him as well. What were you hoping he was going to take away from understanding the importance of these labs? What were you trying to get across to him?
Well, there's a part of the lab's mission which is to do deep scientific research in basic areas to increase human understanding. And there's a part of the laboratory's mission that is to get this science out in our economy, and so it contributes to economic growth. And that both of these are crucially important. It's also important to Illinois. You know, Illinois's big financial problem is that it loses roughly $40 billion every single year because we pay a lot more in federal taxes than we get back in federal spending. And it's only gotten worse with the latest tax bill that did a bunch of targeted provisions that make life harder for Illinois and the large population states. And the national laboratories are one of the only areas where we have a chance to get back a fraction of the tax money that we send to the federal government every year. And so from strictly an Illinois point of view, they're also very important. But nationally, it's the science that's done. You see things like leading-edge battery research that will make cars with several times their current driving range that are being developed by the J. Caesar program at Argonne. You see the neutrino program. You know, these neutrinos are these strange ghost-like particles that will travel through the Earth without interacting. Fermilab is now building a neutrino beam to shoot them to South Dakota, where there'll be a large underground detector, and scientists from all over the world are just clamoring to get this experiment built. We've seen big contributions to the program at Fermilab, from commitments from the United Kingdom, from Europe, from the Indians, because not only the scientific excitement over the program at Fermilab, but the technology that they want to be a part of developing. And so it was wonderful to see Secretary Perry exposed to this. And the presentations he got from the young scientist, you could see he was just, you could see him light up with the presentations and the enthusiasm that he felt. Although he didn't, always understand the technical details, I guess my job was to go and make that translation.
Do you think he did a good job with that?
Yeah, he did.
Okay.
He did. I think the only area where he was clearly well above me is when we visited the buffaloes at Fermilab. They have a buffalo herd there.
And oh, yeah, the bison, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. And he knew the bison inside and out. And so he was, I guess he got his degree in animal science. And so he knew all about, bison genetics and all this sort of stuff. So,
oh, interesting. So the Department of Energy, of course, is the one to request the funding. What's your sense of what Secretary Perry and the Department of Energy is going to do with funding requests for the two labs?
Well, that is one of the questions that may hopefully be answered partially this week, when we hopefully do not shut down the government and come up with a funding compromise that doesn't do things like cut fundamental research. The other thing that's going to be happening in the next few weeks is that we're going to see the second Trump administration budget proposal. And I was very pleased, frankly, that the first Trump administration proposal was essentially ignored by both Democrats and Republicans in Congress. President Trump decided to put a guy by the name of Mick Mulvaney, a former congressman that I served with for many years on the Financial Services Committee, and he put him in charge of preparing a budget. And the budget that he prepared was so reactionary and just inadequate in so many ways that it got ignored by both the Republicans and the Democrats in Congress. It was essentially a dead letter. And so now, a year later, we're seeing a second budget proposal, and I hope they've learned their lesson and they have something that's a little bit realistic, because you're not going to get an agreement to have massive cuts to medical research, to basic scientific research, as well as all of the safety net programs that people in this country depend on.
Congressman, I imagine there are people listening and maybe some of your colleagues in Congress who would say all of that's great, but why should taxpayer money be going to fund this research and these labs? What would be your response to that? Why do you think that labs need funding from the government?
Well, there are short-term applied research that is done routinely and, frankly, I think most efficiently by industry. When they see a product and they know exactly how it will be, how the technology will be applied to it, there is usually no shortage of investment money available for that. However, there are a lot of fundamental research questions, which are, much of it is curiosity-driven research. And so these are things where you have no idea how it will eventually benefit humanity, or whether it will simply be something that an important fact that will be put in the science textbooks forever. For example, when we were building the giant accelerator at Fermilab, because we needed to have the accelerator powerful enough to eventually discover the top quark, the heaviest known form of matter, we knew it had to be superconducting. And so we put the scientists at Fermilab put a huge amount of effort into getting industrial production of superconducting strand with a very high performance and a very low cost. And after we developed this and used it successfully for the magnets, the superconducting accelerator magnets at Fermilab, we could not prevent it from being used for medical MRI imaging equipment that, has saved, probably millions of people's lives at this point by being able to look inside someone's body without cutting them open. And so this is an example of the unexpected benefits of doing fundamental scientific research. The payoff is often not immediate. The payoff may happen decades in the future, and that's too long a time scale to get investors to put money in, but it's a perfectly appropriate thing to use of taxpayer money, because the benefit is to the country as a whole.
Representative Foster, last time you were on the program, I believe it was actually a year ago, and it was in the middle of a lot of national conversation around science and science mattering and people feeling as if scientists in particular feeling attacked by the Trump administration. A year later, do you feel like things have improved? Does it seem like we're in a better position now?
Well, I have to say that we dodged the bullet on the budget. You know, it's sort of remarkable, the budget that we're operating under, you know, after a series of what are called continuing resolutions, is essentially the budget that was negotiated by with the Obama administration. And so that's, you know, a remarkable statement on how Democrats and Republicans have looked at the proposals from the Trump administration and said these budgetary proposals are nonsense. You know, I hope, frankly, that that continues, that we continue with bipartisan support for science. On the other hand, there are areas, for example, climate change, where we have seen sort of our worst fears playing out. You see the Trump administration's appointees to run the Environmental Protection Agency who explicitly reject the science of climate change. And this is, and you see them deliberately trying to drive the scientists out of the EPA because they simply don't want their voices heard in the debate over how we make a transition from fossil fuels to a sustainable energy mix. And so this is, that's an area where I can't say that there's been a lot of forward progress, and a lot of scientists remain very concerned.
As we're talking about this, as we're talking about science, as we're talking about funding, I wanted to just bring the question of immigration into this. I don't know if you would you support a spending plan that didn't include a deal on deferred action for childhood arrivals or DACA or the Dreamers?
I would have a lot of trouble. You know, this is a source of huge frustration. The Dream Act, dealing with the DACA kids, this is something that if it would be brought before Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate, as a standalone issue, would win by a large vote. And what the Republicans are doing as a negotiating tactic is effectively to use them as hostages to attach to the Dream Act many proposals that are not bipartisan. These are Republican initiatives that they cannot pass as standalone measures, but they are attaching them to the Dreamers, using them almost as hostages on this, to get something that, you know, basically to thwart the will of the American public that the Dream Act, you know, to get some relief and some future for these kids who were brought to this country, you know, often as very young children, who have known no other country than the United States, to give them some future. And this is something where Democrats and Republicans support it, and using them as hostages in a budget negotiation to get Republican priorities through, for which the Republicans, who are, by the way, running this place, cannot get a direct up or down vote that their own members will support, and trying to use these hostages to get Democratic votes is, I don't know, it's not a glorious moment for our democracy and creating a lot of trouble.
One last question for you, Representative Foster. On that note, obviously a lot of the news this past weekend was dominated by comments that President Trump made, very vulgar remarks about people from specific countries. And one of the reasons we know this is because your colleague in the Senate, Senator Durbin, was at the meeting. President Trump has now, in the past, you know, recent days, sort of engaged in a Twitter fight with Senator Durbin about the remarks that he made. I wonder your thoughts on that, and if how you feel about the way that that's playing out, as well as if you think that will have repercussions for an overall immigration deal.
Well, it certainly hasn't helped. You know, there's sort of two levels at which this is playing out, one of which is what is the truth of what transpired. And it's interesting that organizations like the Wall Street Journal are being fairly unambiguous on they have good contacts with many of the people that were in that room, and they are not being ambiguous about what they think was said. And I think one of the lessons that everyone should learn is that when you start repeatedly saying things that are not true, often when it's not too important, then when it's really important about having your version of the truth understood, and if you've blown your credibility, you have paid a price personally and for our country that will last as long as you are, you know, in charge. And I think that is, you know, if there is a positive lesson to be learned, you know, by the children that are unfortunately watching this, it is your personal credibility is something that is important to you and to every organization you work with throughout your life. And I think you're seeing the administration pay the price in terms of the credibility when different versions of this, of what transpired, get talked about.
Congressman Bill Foster is a Democrat. He represents Illinois' 11th congressional district. Joining us from Washington, thanks for taking the time to speak with us, Congressman.
No, happy to do so.
That does it for us today. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21ST Show. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. For our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All of those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.